Thank you, Noor, for coming on the podcast today. I really appreciate you taking the time. You are the founder and CEO of ORCID, a reproductive technology company measuring genetic proposition to disease. So, in layman's terms, basically, you guys are working to help people have healthier babies, or at least help people, maximize the probability that their kids have healthy lives and protect from some of the potential risks of having a kid when you don't really know what your genetics, might make them vulnerable to, and things like that. And before starting ORCID, you went to Stanford and did the Teal Fellowship. So, very interesting story and lots of great sort of progress with the company thus far. But I think the best place to get started would be I usually start with people's kind of origin stories from as early as they're willing to start to where they are today and talking through some of the decisions that they made along the way. But I was reading an old blog post of yours on how to get to know someone. And I saw an interesting question that you like to ask people, which is how did their parents meet? So, I thought that might be kind of an interesting place to start. And if you want to, skip that and go straight into your origin story, that works too. But let's learn about you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. No, I'll raise you. How did my parents meet? And I'll start with my grandma's story because I actually feel like she's like the most inspiring probably person in my family. So she grew up in Pakistan. She had five kiddos. She got married at 16, which was like normal at the time. And she while she was in Pakistan, she was like, I need to figure out how to get my kids to America. Like America's like the place to be. I need to go over there. So after she had five kids, she left those kids with my grandfather and just bolted for America. Basically, her brother was trying to run for political office, and she kind of just pulled the cord on him and was like, "Hey, forget about politics in Pakistan. Like, America's where it's at. Let's go to America." So she basically right turns his life, convinces him to go to America, and they go to America together. So she's like working two jobs, and basically that's how my mom ended up in the US. So yeah, I just feel like her story is really badass because I feel like even today, if you were to say like, just leave your kids across the country, it would be pretty crazy. It's like a really big sacrifice today, even though you have like FaceTime and you have all this ability to like actually like see and like connect with your family. So I feel like it was just even crazier that she did that back then. So I feel like there's always been like kind of a like matriarch streak in my family because of that. So that's my grandma's story. And then she was like really aggressive in the way that she like was obsessed with like education for all of her kids. So all of her kids are engineers. So my mom's an engineer, my dad's an engineer, and they actually met in college. I think, yeah, because they were both doing like EE, which is like I don't know, which was like the AI of the time, I guess, because everyone was doing every like I think Pakistani person like in that era was doing electrical engineering. And then yeah, so both my parents like moved across the world from Pakistan to they went to school in DC. And basically from DC, they never left more than like a 60-mile radius. So I grew up in Northern Virginia, and my parents were like super against any like international travel in terms of like when it came to family vacations. They were like, let's go to like every national park in the US. So yeah, I don't know, it's just kind of funny how like immigrants are always like way more patriotic, I think, than people who grew up here. And actually, it wasn't until I went back to Pakistan, like, I don't know, I think some trip that my sister organized when I was like maybe, I don't know, 12 or 10 or something like that. And yeah, when I went there, I was sort of like expecting to be like, oh, this is like why I'm weird, is I'm gonna just go to Pakistan and I'm gonna find out that like, it's actually just because of like this cultural thing. And then going there and sort of realizing, oh, okay, I'm just like weird in another way. It doesn't have anything to do with the fact that my parents are from here. So yeah, I think that's actually was actually the big turning point for me in terms of like becoming super patriotic. Because I think up to that point, I was sort of like, why do my parents like, why are they so against every other country? Why are they so obsessed with America? Like, because when you go to school, everyone like is like, oh, I went to Italy or Paris or something else, and you're always kind of like, oh, I wish my parents were interested in going there too. So anyways, I think it's kind of a really long origin story because mainly going into my family. But yeah, so that's my how my parents got here. They're both Pakistani immigrants, and they're like really obsessed with education. That's why I think it was like a really big deal for them to be supportive for the Teal Fellowship. So I had like a I would say pretty conventional like like up until like high school, basically. Like I just lived in suburbia, was like really excited about like anything that wasn't school. Like I wasn't that excited about school, but because my parents are immigrants, you sort of have to, be excited about like getting good grades. But that was like not, fortunately, it wasn't that hard. So I had like a lot of time outside of that to do other things. But yeah, so I was really happy when I found out about the Teal Fellowship, and they basically as soon as I saw what it was, I was like immediately like super thrilled, and was like, this has to be the thing that I do. So basically I just like spent a ton of like way more time on my like Teal Fellowship application than any of my college applications, because I was like, okay, well, worst case, I'll go to college, like hopefully like I get to do this Teal Fellowship thing first, or only that. So yeah, I think it was like a really big deal when my parents were like happy for me and excited about that, because originally they like didn't want me to go to school more than like, 3 or 4 hours away from home. I think though that they didn't realize that what the Teal Fellowship actually meant was that, I was actually going to be across the country. I think they had this like weird belief that like I was going to like do a startup like from my basement or something like that. So that part was a little bit of a reckoning. But I think everyone kind of growing up, like whether you do something weird like the fellowship or not, end up having like a point of tension in their life with their parents. So I think they ended up being like worried about me and things like that. But I think they were basically, as I got more confident and excited about it and like was seeing more success, they kind of like chilled out. But I think now looking back, like thinking about like a 17 or 18 year old like just like moving across the country by themselves into like a group home, like now that I've seen that happen, I'm like, oh my goodness, okay, I see why my parents were so worried. But at the time you have like so much excitement, and you're not, I feel like every 18 year old like feels really invincible and like doesn't realize that like there's so much that they don't know. So I think I was in that same boat too. Anyways, I think that's kind of my, I think that's kind of my origin story. I mean, in terms of like why I got excited about ORCID, it actually started pretty early on in my life. So my mom has this condition called retinitis pigmentosa. So she started progressively going blind in her 30s. So when she was first diagnosed, they like didn't know what caused it. They didn't know if it was something that was going to affect like my aunts and uncles, or were going to affect us, like meaning like me and my siblings. And then eventually it sort of, more as like more people got sequenced, it kind of got, it got more well understood. So I think, when you're that young, it's really just about like seeing someone you love and seeing like their independence getting stolen from them and like the consequences of that. So I think that was really what got me interested in, like genetics, I think from an early age, was sort of, it's like, hey, you have this like lottery ticket, which is your genome, and it either like guarantees you a like pretty healthy life with like not that many complications, or you get unlucky like my mom did, and you're basically, so, like a major part of your independence or a huge amount of your time gets sucked up in like managing this disease rather than like living your life and like kind of, going about your business. So I think that's what got me interested in genetics. And then when I was at, when I was at Stanford, I was working on like a bunch of different projects. I was working on computer vision stuff. I was working on some genomics projects, and like it was kind of just like really fortuitous, I would say, that like basically everything came together for me to be able to teach this class called Frontiers in Reproductive Technology, where I got to teach the computational side. And then there was a REI, so fertility doctor, that taught the clinical side. And then there was the lab director, so the embryologist at Stanford's IVF lab, that taught the embryology side. And basically getting to connect with both of those folks really like kind of paved the way for ORCID to get started, because as I got older, it became less about like, is this disease going to affect me, and much more about, is this going to be something that's going to affect, like my future family, like whenever, I decide to have a family. And then basically it was really cool talking to them, because they kind of validated that of like, hey, this is not just something that, is something that you're worried about. This is something that like basically every single patient who comes through is worried about, is that, hey, they're like spending all of this time and energy to, to create embryos and to have kiddos. And, The last thing that they want is for that kid to, you know, get affected by a disease that runs in their family or that, you know, spontaneously occurs. You know, basically each of us, like you and I, have like 60 novel mutations. You know, you and I are fine. They're all benign mutations, but sometimes those mutations or typos happen in really critical genes, and then they result in like super catastrophic diseases. So yeah, it's like really cool, honestly, to have this like full circle moment from like, I honestly like was interested in this when I applied for the like Thiel Fellowship, like more than I guess 10 years ago now. And like, you know, seeing what my mom went through. So it's like really cool to have actually built something that people are using today to like test their embryos so that like the thing that affected me and my mom, you know, fundamentally gets to be a choice for future people rather than it being a lottery, right? Like that's kind of like fundamentally the thing that I wanted to change is that, hey, I want like every future kid, every future parent to have the superpower that they didn't have, that, you know, humanity didn't have before, which is that they can basically mitigate or measure the risk to many more diseases, and they can sort of take control and have a lot more confidence about like kind of the most important sort of shift that happens in your life, which is like when you become a parent.
Yeah, well, it's a great story. I appreciate you sharing it. And I definitely want to talk a lot about ORCID. But before we do that, I would love to kind of plug into a couple of points from your story that I thought were pretty interesting. First was talking about like when you were a kid feeling kind of like weird, and then like hoping that when you went to Pakistan, you'd be like, oh, this is why I'm weird. Like, you know, all people from here are just like me. But like, you know, I'm just not like these other people that I'm around in America. But then you went and you were like, well, that's not really it. I'm just kind of like weird. What, like, in what ways as a kid did you think like that you were weird? Was it like that you were, did you always kind of see yourself as like wanting to be an entrepreneur or something different like that? Or you mentioned not really being interested in school. Like what were the types of things that you were interested in as a kid? Was there anything that sort of forecasted kind of what you're doing today?
I don't think that I knew I wanted to like start companies when I was like really little. I just think, I don't really know what I mean when I say like I was weird. I think that, what do I mean by weird? I don't know. I never really got along with like a lot of other kids. I mean, I had like very few friends, I think, in like growing up in every school. I mean, some of that was probably due to like moving around a bit. So like I wasn't always in the same school. But yeah, I just think other kids were always like, that's the weird girl or something. So I don't know. I don't think I ever thought I was weird, but I think other people were always like, oh my God, she's weird. I don't know. I think maybe just like super hyper and really excitable. Like I just really liked, I don't know. I kind of just always liked like going into a hole on the internet and like finding something and then doing it. Like I really liked doing things, and I really didn't like school because it always felt like busy work and like felt like babysitting and like childcare. And I was kind of like, I always thought that, I still think this, that like adults really underestimate kids. Like I think kids are like basically like, yeah, I don't know, just like way smarter and more capable than people give them credit for. And I think now we're seeing that a lot more because there's things like Replit and all this stuff where like you can have like an anonymous identity, so you don't even realize that you're dealing with a kid and they're like a better programmer than like anyone on your team, or they're like, I don't know, just able to like build stuff and do stuff. And I think that I was always really, I was just really excited about that. I think basically how I channeled that, like when I was like super young, was like nonprofit stuff. Like I like had a nonprofit and I was like trying to, you know, just help like various different types of like disadvantaged groups. And I just thought that was so much more useful. I was like, this is like a way better use of my time than like, you know, whatever random like assignment that I would try to do just as fast as possible. Yeah, I think that's probably a bad answer, but that's, I think, the honest one. Yeah.
No, yeah, that's great. I think I'm definitely pro weird. And I think a lot of schooling kind of, the almost the impact of it is to kind of like beat the weird out of kids, or like, you know, using a maybe a more positive word than weird, like the kind of uniqueness out of kids, where you enter school and you sort of have all this energy and excitement and all these things that you're interested in, and then you're kind of taught like, well, you need to become well-rounded and you need to like learn this subject and that subject and do this assignment and that assignment, and if you get things, you know, there's a right and there's a wrong and you have to get things right and you have to memorize this and you have to memorize that. But really, I think, you know, like you mentioned with Replit or all these, you know, there's different sort of forms of education that are coming online that hopefully are more personal and more geared towards like encouraging people to kind of pursue their weirdness or pursue their like uniqueness and get better at the things that like they're best at and go in the directions that they're passionate about. So I'm, you know, I'm generally an optimist, but in particular on education, I'm, despite the system being seemingly pretty broken, and obviously that's a large part of why the Thiel Fellowship came about in the first place. But I think we're seeing some more interesting approaches. And at the very least, I think people like you and I are more conscious about how we want to educate our kids eventually and, you know, maybe not put them through sort of that same system that we experienced as being like not great. So anyway, help me with the timeline on the Thiel Fellowship. You mentioned like you applied, it sounded like right out of high school alongside a bunch of colleges, but you did go to Stanford, right? And then you went to the Thiel Fellowship and then you went back to Stanford?
No. So I did the Thiel Fellowship right out of high school. So yeah, I think I was, I guess, 18 or so when I started it. So then I went to Stanford 2 years later. So I basically did the Thiel Fellowship for 2 years. And then, yeah, I went to Stanford as a, I guess I was 20 when I started. Yeah. So then I did my undergrad and master's at Stanford in, yeah, computer science. There's only one major at Stanford. And then, yeah. And then basically right after I taught the class, I taught the class like my, while I was the, well, I think I did the, at Stanford, they call it a co-term. So it's like, you can like kind of squeeze your master's if you are like really intelligent about it into like four, most people do it in five. I did it in like 4 1/4. So I taught that class, toward the end of that, period as well. And then basically, yeah, I was really lucky. I sort of like tweeted about the class, and then like the first investors for Orchid ended up coming just like in my inbox. And I was like, oh, this is crazy. Why are like these like important people interested in my like random Stanford class? And I was like applying to PhD programs, like got accepted into a few. And then I was like, well, do I want to like write about this, or do I want to actually do this? And yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's really funny because the Thiel Fellowship was like, you know, contrarian thing to do. And then like, after the Thiel Fellowship, going to Stanford was like the, you know, contrarian thing to do. But both of them felt like really easy choices for me at the time. Like I feel like the Thiel Fellowship was like easily like one of the best decisions I ever made. Like I think, I don't know. I think people should take gap years or just like try to pursue whatever thing it is that they want to do like immediately, and then just like fail or like see what happens, and then basically evaluate what they think the best next step would be from there. Because I feel like I would have gotten like 10% or 5% of the value that I got from Stanford if I hadn't done the Thiel Fellowship before. And but yeah, at the same time, I think that like the company Orchid, like I almost tried to start it 10 years ago, and I'm glad I didn't, because it wasn't really like all the tech wasn't really ready. I would have probably been struggling up until this, like, you know, similar point to get like the product out. But yeah, basically I feel like it was really critical for me to go to Stanford to be able to start the company, because of a lot of the critical people that were needed came from there. And then there was a bunch of like technical stuff that I needed to learn and understand to be able to build those parts of the product. So I don't know, I guess I just find it really funny, because a lot of times when I talk to people about it, they're like, oh my God, that was like so courageous or so brave that you did this or that. And I'm like, it didn't feel like that at the time. It just felt obvious, right? Like if you tell an 18-year-old like, hey, you can go like apprentice with like someone who like wants to build stuff, like if you tell them, hey, you can go like meet some of the people who built all the stuff that you use or all the stuff that you think is cool, like obviously they're gonna say yes, right? And yeah, I don't know, for me at the time, I really wanted, after like spending time like building products and selling products, I really wanted to spend time like just learning stuff that I thought would be super foundational and useful. And then that's what I got to do at Stanford, and I really enjoyed it in a way that I don't think I would have if I, you know, hadn't had that experience of like, hey, these are like the gaps in your knowledge, or these are the things that'll be really valuable to you when you like want to go build teams or build products later.
Yeah, that definitely resonates a lot. I'm a huge fan of the gap year. I took one between my freshman and sophomore year and tried to start a company and failed. And then, you know, after my first job, I quit and ended up taking like a year or 18 months before my next thing. And even right now, I'm kind of in like this gap thing. I just like to kind of live in seasons where I like work really hard for a long time and then kind of take a step back and figure out what my next big commitment's going to be and just go from there. Because people just kind of jump from one lily pad to the next, and they're not super thoughtful about, I mean, this is generalization, but I feel like people feel this pressure that, you know, right when you leave one thing, whether it's high school to college or college to your first job or your first job to your second job, there's this like arbitrary urgency to go. And, you know, you can't stop the first thing until you have the second thing lined up or whatever. And if you actually just take time to just kind of like relax and see what you like, I'm not relaxing for the purpose of like not working. Like I end up working a ton, but I'm working on things that are like interesting to me. And then you just kind of like follow, you don't really know what the third step in front of you is going to be, but you can kind of see the first one and then you can see the next one. And then next thing you know, you're doing something really cool that it might've taken like a year between things to get there, but it might've taken 20 years to get there if you just kind of like blindly guessed at what the next best thing was and kept jumping the lily pads or whatever. And yeah, definitely a double contrarian move by you to go and do the Thiel Fellowship and then go back to Stanford. And to your point, I think it's like, you know, the Thiel Fellowship, I'm sure as a standalone experience was super valuable, but then the kind of level up in your Stanford experience that it probably gave you to have that perspective where everyone else coming in as a freshman for the most part is just like coming from high school and you just went and did this really cool thing for a couple of years and like you're
that
more
was the other thing
mature.
About Stanford that I thought was so funny is I just got so much respect at Stanford that I didn't deserve for doing the Thiel Fellowship. Like there's all this, so to be clear, like I was definitely not the smartest person at Stanford. Like that was actually something that I really loved and was super humbling. Like it was like really easy for me, like in high school and like growing up, like I didn't have to try that hard. And I was like, whatever, at the top of whatever, some small, you know, some small pond. And yeah, I just loved meeting all these people at Stanford with just this insane horsepower. Like they just like watch a lecture, the same one that you're in. And you can tell they just have this like insanely deep understanding, either because they took a bunch of classes or it's just something they have like this insane natural aptitude for. And I don't know, I just really liked doing that. And I think that if I hadn't had the Thiel Fellowship, I would have been way more intimidated by that. And I think weirdly, like I got so many extra opportunities at Stanford because they were like, oh, like this is a, like whatever person from the Thiel Fellowship, like let's give her this thing, you know, which I would have just been one of the other, you know, freshmen if I hadn't had that other weird experience that basically like got me into like a bunch of labs earlier, like just, I don't know, just gave me more confidence that I don't think I don't know, maybe other people have because they did something else. But for me, like it just gave me this set of confidence because there was something that I could like teach other people, even though like, you know, whatever they were better at, you know, some like insane like math proof or whatever thing that, you know, people who like spent their 10,000 hours on that, you know, what the result of their 10,000 hours was.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds like you got a whole lot out of the Stanford experience, whether it was from the Thiel Fellowship or otherwise, certainly did a lot. I know, among other things, you mentioned a lot about like, you know, teaching the class there and everything, but you also started a, I think it was called the Stanford Center for Distributed Trust, which was like sort of a crypto thing. And this was like, you know, at least, you know, I don't know, 5 years ago or something like that. How did you get into crypto? How did you get exposed to that like early? And what was like the driving kind of interest to go and actually like start a club around it?
Yeah, I think it's honestly just like the like the math around it is really interesting. Basically like just this problem of like how do you get people who you know are untrusted, how do you get them to transact in a way that in a way online where you know there's not a centralized party. So I think it was really just like the, at least I think for like the academic interest, it's really more just like how do you solve this puzzle of like you want all these people to be able to exchange data or money or whatever in a way that preserves privacy or that handles this issue of like not having like a centralized entity to trust. So I think that's kind of where you know that interest came from. And then like most things, if there's like a group of like really smart people who you really love working with, you kind of just get pulled into it. So yeah, I don't know. I think that's kind of like how that ended up happening. It was like an awesome class and then like an awesome group of people. And then like, I think we ended up like teaching, basically hosting a class and then basically getting a bunch of speakers to come in and talk about some of the different aspects of it. Like there's like, you know, so many different types of protocols and there's so many different ways to solve that problem. And it was sort of cool to be able to like showcase all of those people, all that work and, you know, help people implement things and help kind of basically make things kind of cross that chasm of like, hey, here's like an awesome idea, but then like, here's something that like can actually come out of it in the real world.
Yeah, totally. And I appreciate you, you know, taking this bit of a detour. I know you're probably day to day very focused on Orchid, so I definitely want to spend some time there now, but appreciate the story. It's always interesting to me to hear kind of how people got to where they are. So Orchid, we talked a little bit about the, you know, the original motivation from watching your mother grow up and then having this interest even when you first applied to the Thiel Fellowship. Maybe you could just describe, I know you're in a bit of a different chapter with Orchid now than you were when you first started with like focus on more of like the saliva test and things like that. So maybe you could talk about like when you first launched Orchid, what was the initial product and why was that like a good place to get started?
So the first thing that we launched was a saliva-based test. So what that means is that parents, before they decide whether or not to do IVF or how they want to have kids, they can just spit in a tube, and then we basically model recombination. So we simulate what their embryos or kids would look like in terms of their risk distribution. So the point of that tool was really just to kind of answer this question for people, which is like, will IVF help me mitigate risk? Like, what are the risks that I have, and then how much can I mitigate that risk by selecting embryos? So yeah, that was kind of the initial product, just because, it unfortunately, like anything with atoms takes longer than things with bits. So that was kind of like a really lightweight, like much lighter weight product to get moving on, versus for the embryo screening, which, we just kind of announced last week. You have to sequence hundreds of embryos, you have to get it validated, you have to do CLIA and CAP. There's like obviously all these steps that you have to go through to be able to handle those samples. So that's kind of what we wanted to do as a kind of baby step to kind of like enter the market, kind of tell people, get people's minds primed with this whole idea of embryo selection, because I think it has like this the potential to mitigate like a massive amount of risk, but it's just not in the zeitgeist, I think, as much as it should be, right? People don't realize that. I don't know. I just think people don't think about it. They don't realize it's an option, that hey, like it doesn't have to be the case that you roll the dice. It could be the case that you analyze everything up front and then have the child that's least likely to be affected by something. So I think that was kind of the point of that product, was basically just to kind of like stake a name and say, hey, if you want to quantify your risk in this really lightweight way, which I don't think anyone's scared of like spitting in a tube, then you can do that. And then basically in parallel, we were always working on basically the embryo product, because that's the cool thing, right? You measure your risk, but then you can actually mitigate or do something about it with the embryo report.
Right. And it seems like to me there's like a couple of good aspects of that. One is that it's much more accessible. I think maybe you can sort of speak to the price points a little bit of like the saliva test versus if you're actually going to go to like the IVF route and everything. So yeah, maybe we could start there.
So the saliva test is like around, I think it's like $900 for like both partners. If you're only sequencing one partner, I think it's about half of that. And then the IVF side just depends on the number of embryos that you have. So if you're talking about 10 embryos, it's like 25,000. If you're talking about, five embryos, it's like, 12,500. It's about like half that. If you're talking about one embryo, it's 2,500. So, it just depends how, basically, depending on the age of the female partner, usually is what's driving the number of eggs, and therefore the number of embryos that you're able to produce. So yeah, that's kind of just ballpark in terms of what the pricing is.
Yeah, so the first thing is the pricing that it's accessible to go and do the saliva test for most people who, if you prioritize this, which I would argue, you should. It's like a you make this great analogy I've heard on other podcasts where it's like people spend more time like doing research on Yelp for like where they're going to go get lunch than they do like, sort of the genetic risks for like their kids. And it just doesn't really make much sense. But it's not to say people are like dumb so much as just like I don't think people are really aware. And even if you are like aware, like maybe you listen to this podcast and then 5 years from now, you're thinking of having kids and you haven't really been exposed to any other content around this or information around this. And you kind of forget the podcast. It's just like, well, this isn't kind of the norm yet. So I'm just going to go and like sort of have kids and be blind. But if you can spend, several $100 to go and even just get the saliva test done, basically the question I have is like, if that comes back with certain results that show that you're actually like not that high risk to pass on things to your kids, is that kind of like a sensible step where like you can take that first step and not even necessarily like it's not even necessarily a path to go forward with the IVF? It's just like, hey, let's see how this comes back. And if it's like red flags everywhere, then we should seriously consider this, several thousand to $25,000 investment in the IVF. But if it comes back pretty clean, and we're not really of like the economic means to go and pay $25,000 or even $10,000 or whatever it is, we can kind of roll the dice with more confidence that we've done a little bit of research here and we can feel good about going forward. Is that kind of right?
I mean, I think fundamentally, like role is really just to give the highest quality data. And then it's like up to parents, their families, or clinical team to make a decision about what it is they want to do. So yeah, I think that, you know, it's a lot more confidence. It's a lot more, you know, reassuring to know that there's not any big red flags. There is, like I said, that chance of a spontaneous change happening in an embryo where even if both partners, you know, don't basically are all green, don't have anything that could potentially harm an embryo or a future child, there is a chance of a spontaneous change, which you, you know, can only learn from when you're doing embryo screening. But at the same time, those are much more rare, right? Being able to just at least take all of the obvious risks off the table, I think is something that, you know, I think hopefully will be standard of care. Like right now, what standard of care is a really limited set of things called carrier screening. So carrier screens are anywhere from like 100 to like 400 only recessively inherited conditions. So basically, I don't know, it's really hard for me to understand besides like info hazard, but basically like the, I don't know, I think the medical genetics community is like a little bit paternalistic, I think, in terms of like, we only want to tell you this really small amount of information because we're afraid that if you know more information, then you're going to interpret it incorrectly. And I think that, you know, if you're in that field and you're kind of seeing people day in and day out make mistakes and misinterpret information that they're getting, I can see how that that cult ends up, that cult of opinion kind of ends up guiding the community, right? Because there's been people who like misinterpreted their, you know, breast cancer results and they like go get a mastectomy, right? And then it's, they're told that actually this is like, you know, not what they thought it was. It's not like you're, you have a really high risk of breast cancer, but rather it's like something super mild and like they just didn't understand their results, right? So I think when stuff like that happens, you know, I think the, you know, the medical community gets really activated, but I think that the problem is that that's probably much rarer than, basically they see it all the time because that's like, you know, they're a specialist and they're basically only getting referred to these like super complicated, horrible scenarios. But, you know, at least when we've done like comprehension studies or we've done, you know, just any study that we've done where we've tried to quantify, do people understand their results? What is the emotional distress or lack of distress that people get from their results? It's incredibly high for comprehension and incredibly low for emotional distress. So, I think it's exactly kind of like what you were saying about Yelp and like people doing research on like where they go to lunch, right? Like when people have the opportunity to do research about a thing that they care about, like only in a minor way, they will do it. So it just seems like really crazy to me when it comes to like some, a decision that's like super impactful, totally can change the trajectory of your life, change the trajectory of the life of the person that you care about most, that any information would be withheld or censored. And it's like, I don't know, people are smart, right? They're like getting mortgages. They're like, you know, spinning up, you know, their own companies. I feel like I default to thinking that people have a lot of agency and are really smart. Like I've constantly seen this pattern where like specialists will be taught about the disease that they're supposed to be a specialist in by their patients with the disease, right? Because like that patient is just so much more motivated. They will read every single paper, everything that's new that comes out in a much different way than a specialist will, because they just have, you know, every single minute of their day is booked by seeing patients and they're kind of giving them like kind of the same recipe that like the medical society decided on for the last year based on their last annual meeting, right? So I think there's like something to be said for like, if you're personally motivated about something, like you can, yeah, just go a lot further than people will give you credit for. And again, it's just those 10,000 hours, right? If you choose to spend those 10,000 hours on the disease that affected, you know, your family or your loved one, then, you know, you're going to become, you know, an expert in that. So I think, yeah, when it comes to kids, I just feel like people take it really seriously, right? They like choose usually today to like have them later, to like plan for it. And I think they deserve like the maximum amount of information that's like well curated, you know, when they make that decision.
Yeah, the other thing about the information like paradox, or I'm not sure what exactly to call it, but I feel like there's a big difference when there's an opportunity to do something about it once you have the information versus when there's not. So like one thing I remember, I don't know if it was like 5 years ago or something like that, I got the 23andMe test, and I was thinking, like, I feel like at the time I was seeing people get the test and just like not really think about it too much, and it was like confusing to me. I was like, you're gonna get this like full picture of your genome and like see these things that you're like genetically predisposed to, and like to me there's a very valid question there, if especially in a world where if you can't do anything about it, there, I think it's reasonable to be like, well, you know, do I want to know, right? Like, it's, to me, I like thought about it a lot. I was like, this is like a really cool test and an awesome opportunity, but do I want to know? And I ended up getting it because I basically came to the conclusion that there was things I could do about it. Like, yeah, you can't do anything about your genes, at least, you know, not really yet, but you can, you know, if you see that you're predisposed to some particular thing, there's still like preventative actions that you can take like over the course of your life to mitigate that thing. And so I was like, you know what, like, yeah, I could kind of go like the ignorance is bliss route or whatever, but if there's something that I could do about something that I'm like predisposed to over the next, you know, 20, 30, 50 years, whatever, I would like to know so that I can do that thing. And then I was like, I felt very fortunate. It came back. It was like really good. There wasn't like that much on it. I think there's like early onset Alzheimer's or something, which is like not great, but you know, it's like, I can, okay, like fine. That's like kind of down the road. And again, like maybe I can like sort of be aware of that. And like, maybe there's things I can do over time. But in general, it was like, is really good. And I was really happy that I did it. And if there was something that came up that was worse, I think I still would have been happy to like kind of know about it and, you know, be able to do what I could to sort of mitigate that. And in this case, it's something where it's like very clearly there's something you can do about it. If you get the saliva test and there's a bunch of red flags, it's like, well, you know, to your point, this is like the most important decision ever. Like, you're starting a family. You know, what are you going to spend $10,000 on that's like better? You know, there's, maybe there's like, if you just really can't afford it, like obviously, you know, that makes sense, but especially if it's like not even a huge expense for you, it's kind of just like a no-brainer. And so just kind of like doing your diligence and getting the information and giving yourself the opportunity to have that choice makes a ton of sense. So before we get to, you know, your guys' recent exciting announcement on the whole genome sequencing, maybe we can just speak in terms of like what's been available for, you know, the last few years, where if someone does, you know, want to do the best they can to get all the information they can, what's the process? Like, what were they able to do? And then we can sort of talk about the new announcement sort of with that context about what additionally they can do now.
Yeah. Sorry, there's just a point that you made that I thought was really interesting, which is just that, like, you know, you're like really high agency and like you like thought about like the consequences of this decision. And it just made me think of the fact that basically in France, they don't allow paternity tests, right? They basically think that like that creates too much info hazard of like, okay, well, there's too many children who have like non-paternity and that's going to cause too much chaos. So it's like you require like a, you know, basically government order in order to get just paternity testing done. So anyways, point is I just think that people and societies, I think, can think through what the consequences of this information, like what it is. And I think like, yeah, in the case of adults, we've already kind of made the decision for most people, right? Otherwise 23andMe and these other companies wouldn't exist, is that, hey, this information is like net valuable for an adult. So to me, like an adult is sort of like the least valuable, right? Because we can't change our genetics, right? So like fundamentally, like the most exciting application of this, like for me, is with embryos, because, you know, we're all constantly being told, hey, these are these lifestyle changes that you can make to like move risk, right? Like, hey, you can smoke less or not, don't ideally don't smoke at all, or you can exercise. Those are kind of like the factors that you can modify. So yeah, I just feel like it's like a really cool unlock for humanity now to basically say, hey, like, you know, you get, genetics is actually finally like a movable factor, right? Like that doesn't have to be whatever your base rate of risk is between you and your partner, right? You can actually like tilt it toward lower risk. But anyway, sorry. So you were asking like what's available today and how is ORCA different than what's available today?
Yeah, basically what was available prior to your guys' latest announcement, and then how does that sort of change the landscape?
Yeah. So basically what was available prior to our announcement is something called PGTA, so pre-implantation genetic testing for aneuploidy. So aneuploidy means chromosome count, right? So we're talking about 23andMe, you have 23 pairs of chromosomes, so that your chromosomes are organized from largest to smallest. So chromosome 1 is the largest, and then kind of as you go down, your sex chromosomes are the smallest, meaning they have like the least genetic material on them. So yeah, PGTA detects the presence or absence of chromosomes, right? So if you have a missing chromosome one, right, you're supposed to have two pairs of every chromosome. You know, if you only have one chromosome one, then that's like not enough data to make a human, right? So most aneuploidies or most abnormal chromosome counts are not compatible with life. There's a few that are. So one that's really common, or probably one of the most common, is called Down syndrome. So that's called trisomy 21. So three chromosome 21s. So that's what PGTA detects is you have basically the way that you can think about DNA is it's like a book and you have a table of contents and the table of contents is, you know, these 23 chromosomes. Do you have these 23 chapters or not? So that's what PGTA is testing for. And the contrast between that and what ORCID is ORCID is actually whole genome sequencing. So it's looking at every single letter. So while PGTA is just looking for that one table of contents, do you have, you know, these 23 chapters or not? What ORCID is doing is actually reading every single letter in that book and doing typo checking and saying, okay, is there any spelling errors in on any of these genes? So that's basically just like a massive advance because basically if you're just looking at the table of contents, like imagine if you only did, you know, spell check on a table of contents, right? There's a really small surface area of diseases that you can cover. So yeah, that's basically what the major advance is. There's one other type of testing called PGTM, pre-implantation genetic testing for monogenic disorders. So that's where there's one specific gene that you're worried about. Like, let's say you know you have, you know, cystic fibrosis. So you can design a probe for just that one gene and then detect the presence or absence of that one gene in all your embryos. But your genome has 20,000 genes, so you're not looking at the other, you know, 19,000 plus genes. So that's really what the difference is that basically previously embryo testing was very limited in what it could tell you. It just tells you about chromosomes, which are analogous for chapters, or it tells you about one gene, which is analogous for basically saying, like, let's say you just did the control F, like you did find for like one sentence, right? You just find that one quote, and then you're said, okay, is that quote like present or absent in this book or not? And then you kind of close the book. So yeah, what's really cool about ORCID is that it's a super comprehensive, like typo spell checking, whole genome sequencing on the entire embryo. So there's all sorts of diseases that can occur in basically any gene, right? So there's things called, like a whole category of diseases called neurodevelopmental disorders. So these are things like epilepsy, autism, intellectual disability, like all sorts of like a basket of conditions that falls under neurodevelopmental disorders. There's sort of a basket of conditions that fall under birth defects. So that's things like hearing loss, vision loss, skeletal dysplasias, heart defects, just all sorts of things that can kind of, deformities and stuff that can affect a baby at birth or in the first couple of years of life. And then there's another basket of conditions called sort of like pediatric and hereditary cancers. So we're kind of just screening for all of those things that could be basically really catastrophic, either, you know, during the pregnancy, first couple of years of life, and then adult onset things like adult onset cancers and stuff too.
Yeah, it's a great analogy with the book. And I kind of, even in looking into like your guys' announcement and everything, like it's pretty apparent that it's like 100x sort of improvement. And obviously like in technology, you know, a lot of companies will try to make like a 10% improvement on the competition, right? And like, that's great, but it's probably not going to be like a big venture backed startup, like a runaway success or power law winner type of thing. Whereas like a 10x technology, a company that builds something that's like truly 10x better definitely can be. And that's like, that seems like a reasonable, I mean, it's very ambitious, but like a lot of companies will kind of go and try to like build that 10x product. And if you successfully do it, like you kind of win, unless, you know, a bunch of other people are doing it at the same time or something like that. But if you're 10x the competition, that's like super impressive. And somehow you guys have done like 100x. And I'm curious, like, I don't know if this is like a, you know, ignorant question or whatever, but why, like, how have you been able to go from table of contents or you know, control finds to to like why haven't there been technologies between what existed, you know, a few weeks ago and what you guys have launched just now, where it's like, okay, you can like read a few chapters or something like that? Like, how did it go from 1x to 100x rather than more of a gradual advancement?
I don't know. I think it kind of it's a couple of things. So one, you know, we're kind of standing on the shoulders of giants, right? There's been decades of work and billions of dollars in funding that's gone into single cell sequencing, that's gone into basically building these genetic data sets, right? Because even if we were to get the whole genome and then these data sets didn't exist that said, hey, this typo leads to this disease, that's kind of useless, right? So great, you have all this data, but you have no way to actually tell someone anything actionable about it. So ORCID is sort of coming about at a time where you've had 2 decades and billions of dollars of investment into genomics. I feel like basically, to me, it just seems like the most humble and obvious application of all of this work, right? Because you have multiple embryos by definition when you do IVF. So basically, previously you just had very limited information to decide which embryo to transfer and to pursue for a pregnancy, and now you have a lot more. In terms of the big advance, I don't know. I think people just shouldn't underestimate what they can accomplish if they obsess over something. To me, this was my personal obsession. I just really wanted this to exist in the world. And I think that a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of resistance in the genetics community. A lot of the people that we're relying on to push things forward have weird taboos and hangups, right? So there's just a lot of taboo around giving people more information about their embryos. IVF as a field, reproductive technology as a field, is incredibly underfunded, right? So IVF, for example, was never funded by any public dollars, right? The government refuses, we just have a ban on it, right? The same as stem cells. So I think that's a huge, that's just a huge failure, I think, of our system, that we don't support reproductive technology. I think most people care an enormous amount about having kids and don't care about their last years of life, right? Now, the bulk of the money that's going to be spent on your health is spent in the last couple of weeks of your life when you're 80 or 90 years old. And I think many more people would rather redirect that toward this time of having kids and being able to have kids in a more informed way, in a healthier and safer way. So yeah, basically I was personally really obsessed with this problem. A lot of work has gone into single cell sequencing broadly, and basically I just spent the time to assemble the team of people who were the experts in basically the chemistry, the bioinformatics, the variant analysis, basically just all of the relevant features. And then we just kind of hammered at the problem for years. And now we have sort of the best single cell sequencing that I think anyone's ever done on embryos, which is really cool. So excited for a lot of that stuff too. A lot of these preprints and stuff that we've written are in review right now. So excited for those to kind of be live and for people to look at them. But yeah, I guess the message is mainly just if you're obsessed with something, you should just go pursue that. And if you pursue it aggressively enough for enough years, you'll do something. You'll definitely learn something, but fortunately in our case, we're able to bring something to market that I think will hopefully help a ton of people. So basically, yeah, we definitely didn't do it alone. We're leveraged kind of some of the top labs and experts in the field to help us get here. It's sort of it's improvements on every single step of the process, everything from sample prep. So basically how the embryologist in the IVF lab prepares a couple of cells, the solution that they use to send it, the shipping conditions when they receive it at ORCID's lab, the protocol that we use, basically the chemistry to actually extract the maximum amount of DNA, the sequencing, the bioinformatics. It's sort of we just optimized every single step of the process so that we could get that yield. And there's still definitely, I would say, a lot of haters. There's a lot of people who are parents shouldn't have this much information. This is too much control. This is too much information, things like that. So I think that also, I think that kind of sucks, right? Basically, it holds the field back because it requires someone like me who's kind of coming from CS, who's what do you mean? More data is awesome, right? Versus people in the field have a little bit too much groupthink or self-censorship that, doesn't help people who want this, right? There's a lot of it's really funny though, because whenever I talk to people in the field, they're sort of this is inevitable, right? This is the obvious conclusion, right? Is that you would go from having small segments of information to having all of the information. So they all know that it's the end state, but there's this huge amount of hesitation and discomfort around actually pushing it forward. And I think I just think, our goal is to basically do that in the most responsible and careful way possible, because we obviously want people to have the maximum number of embryos to transfer and consider, right? So I think anytime it comes to babies or reproduction people are like very sensitive and very quick to get really activated. And I think that's good, right? We have this amazing like protective instinct for babies and for vulnerable populations, which we should. But we're also not doing any favors by not telling people about these risks, right? So I think it's just, it's always a balance, right? You don't want to hold a technology back so far that you're basically discounting the value of all of these lives that are being damaged by not knowing this information, but you also, you know, want to make sure that it's like fully vetted and, you know, carefully considered information. And we've tried to be, despite the fact that we're doing whole genome, we've tried to be as like thoughtful and conservative as possible about like, hey, we're only reporting on things that are, you know, really catastrophic. You really don't want, you know, I mean, obviously some people will choose to transfer whatever it is that they want to transfer, but this is information that's going to be, you know, hopefully super useful in your decision-making process and not overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was definitely a combination of sort of your obsession and persistence and passion for the you know, for the company, and then also, you know, like you mentioned, kind of bringing these several like exponentially improving threads together all into like sort of the one natural thing that results from all of those trends. And then lastly, I think it's helpful whenever you see like a, you know, 100x thing like this, it's not surprising to me to hear that there was like some sort of taboo in the industry that's like sort of artificially holding something back to like, you know, the table of contents version or the, you know, control find version. And it's like, we could have done more maybe already, but the taboo is sort of like holding it back. And now you sort of like, you know, get the greatest of all of these exponential threads. And then you also sort of like ignore the taboo. And then, you know, you work hard for a long period of time and you get the 100x improvement. So it's awesome to be able to, I mean, just in general, the announcement was awesome. And it's great to be, you know, talking with you on the podcast at this, you know, serious inflection point that is, you know, has been a long time coming and well-deserved.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, of course. And so practically speaking on, you know, sort of like, I know all of this stuff is quite expensive now and, you know, ideally the costs would come down over time, but what is sort of like the best in breed path right now? It sounds like the whole genome sequencing and the IVF path, like what's the cost on that roughly? And then do you see like particular kind of levers that can drive costs down? And is that going to be, you know, like every year they should come down, or it's like, you know, come back in a decade and maybe it'll be more affordable? How do you see like sort of the trajectory of costs on all of this?
Oh, this is going to get me in trouble. Basically, I think that the cost of IVF could be like comically cheap, right? So if you go to Europe, the cost of IVF is like 25%, so like a quarter of what it is in the US. So yeah, I think that basically right now in the US, REIs, so reproductive endocrinologists, are the ones who are doing IVF. And then, you know, a lot of other places in the world, you have just regular MDs, so not specialists, or nurse practitioners who are doing IVF. So yeah, I think that there's two ways to make IVF cheaper and more accessible. One is to expand. Very simple supply and demand. You know, coming from a, you know, CS person. But yeah, it's basically, you know, you either expand the pool of labor that can provide the service, right? Which means that you know basically let you have other doctors, you have NPs, you basically make less. You make the cost of the most expensive component, which is the specialized labor, cheaper by making that, by leveraging that person, by, you know, giving them a, you know, suite of nurses who are able to help them do, you know, basically the procedure of IVF. And then the other option is to basically mandate that it's covered by insurance, whether that's you know, commercial insurance, or whether that's like fertility benefits by companies, right? So to me, like I said, I think for a lot of people, they would rather have their healthcare dollars, if they could choose, attributed to something like, you know, starting a family rather than toward the end of life. So I think that, I don't know, there needs to be like more advocacy for like, yeah, for IVF coverage, I think overall. And I think obviously with that would come, you know, embryo testing. And like there's a suite of other services that kind of sit around IVF. But right now, the cost of IVF really depends on where in the country you are. I'd say sort of like the most expensive places in the US are maybe like around $25,000 per cycle just for the IVF piece. And then I would say like the most cheap, like the most affordable places in the country are probably around $6,000 or $7,000. And then, yeah, basically in Europe, like Spain, for example, it's like closer to, between like 4 and 6,000 all in. Another huge component of the cost is actually medication. So medication in the US is like, anywhere from 2 to 10 times the cost as it is in other parts of the world. So I don't know. I mean, all of this stuff is just, yeah, it's just choices that society has to make, right? It's sort of like, do we want to, do we want to make drug companies richer, or do we want to give more people access to like fertility medication, right? Do we want people to be supported to have more babies and have, all these different types of families who need IVF, give them the opportunity, or do we want to like, give you more chemo like when you're 80, right? So yeah, unfortunately, like it's not really something that's, fully in Orchid's hands, right? Like sort of society and society at large has to decide how much information they want people to have, and how much they want it to be covered. But if it were up to me, I would say that, this is something that there should be like an enormous amount of investment and support in, because I think, we're all hearing a little bit more and more about fertility collapse, right? This whole idea that we're not at replacement rate, right? Replacement rate would be like 2.1 kids for every woman. And that's not happening for a number of reasons, right? It's not just reproductive technologies, right? It's also like the cost of housing and the cost of childcare and all these other things. But whichever lever it is that you can move to make it so that like our society grows rather than shrinks, I mean, I think people should be working on.
Is there any like medical tourism in this space, like people going to, cheaper states or even like Europe or something like you said to have the procedures like more economically, or is that not a thing for some reason?
Oh no, it's definitely a thing. Yeah, there's lots of fertility tourism happening. Yeah, so people, yeah, lots of Americans will. It's so funny, right? The idea of like Americans going to Europe for something cheap, right? Usually you think of like going to Europe and you're like, oh, it's like going to be like the most expensive like trip, right? But yeah, there's quite a few Americans who will go to Europe for fertility treatment. There's actually quite a bit of fertility tourism to the US as well. Enormous amounts. Basically, people tend to think that Asia is sort of like the most forward when it comes to reproductive technology, but it's actually the US. So people from China, India, Hong Kong, they'll all come to the US, usually to like LA or San Francisco for fertility treatment because, yeah, this is kind of, the West Coast is fortunately one of like the best places in terms of getting access to information. Like surrogacy laws are really good. They protect the intended parent, they protect the surrogates. It's sort of like a nice system to be able to do that for the families that need it. So I think that's also something that like tends to surprise people. They're like, oh, well, I bet if I go to China that I can get all this stuff. And it's like, no, actually China doesn't allow actually doesn't allow reporting on like sex, for example. So that's something that you can get that information anywhere in the US.
Yeah, so basically people who are maybe concerned on costs might go to Europe or might travel like interstate, but people who are more like price agnostic and just want like the best of the best technology are actually coming in droves to the US or maybe California for this stuff. Makes sense. So let's talk about a little bit of like the future of all of this, like where this is all heading if, people continue to kind of look past the taboo and things like that. And right now we're talking obviously a lot about basically, I would call it like defense, like you're trying to mitigate problems. But when you get to like gene therapy and maybe, you take some of these exponential trends that are going and forecast them 5 or 10 years into the future, is there anything in particular that's like exciting to you around what might be possible or on Orchid's roadmap that you could speak to and totally understand if you can't, but just generally speaking, even as to what you expect from the future. And then sort of related to that, actually, even if it's so one question is going to be sort of around like defense offense, and sorry for the double question, but the other is basically for people who are like maybe in their like mid to late 20s or something like that, people like me, frankly, who are going to be starting like a family at some point in like the relatively near future, but they don't have like a particular timeline or whatever. Is there merit to considering like waiting for technologies to get a little bit better even, or like for example, going and doing the table of contents version of the embryo screening 2 years ago, couldn't tell you nearly as much as, your guys' whole genome sequencing today. So it might have been worth it to, if you're 26 years old and like looking to have a kid, it might have been worth it to like wait a couple of years. Is there anything like that that like you think about?
Well, I feel like everyone who I know is always like trying to say, you know what I mean? Basically, the whole problem with like smart people is that they're always like trying to consider all this stuff. They're like, oh my God, when the situations are perfect, like that, then I'll have kids and things like that. But anyways, I get the kind of the spirit of your conversation. Basically, what are kind of like the next like big inflection points in technology? So I would say, I think that the big inflection points for technology are probably, I think, a decade or two out. And I think those are hopefully something called IVG, in vitro gametogenesis. So basically making egg cells from skin cells, making, you could also make sperm cells from skin cells. But basically what this would enable IVF to be fully non-invasive. So right now you have to take hormones for 2 weeks and then extract eggs from the woman's ovaries. It's not that big of a deal. Like plenty of people have a pretty seamless process, but it is a barrier, right? Like you're kind of, you have to stick to yourself in the same city for, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, which a lot of people who are traveling a lot like me, that's, you know, ends up being a little bit challenging. So the idea of basically just being able to give a, you know, saliva sample or a blood sample, and then for those egg cells to just be generated arbitrarily, an arbitrary number of them, is really cool. So I think that technology is probably at least 10 years out from being like FDA approved, available, accessible to people. But I think that'll be an amazing inflection point, because then you basically won't be limited in terms of the number of eggs or embryos that you'll be able to generate. And then this invasiveness will also be removed. So basically there won't be friction, I would say, in the same way that there's currently a little bit of friction to choosing to do IVF. And then I would say the next major inflection point is maybe 20 years or 25 years out, which would be artificial wombs, right? So the idea that, you know, it doesn't have to be the case that the biological mother, you know, carries a pregnancy, but actually there's this like really safe and, you know, there's this really safe exogenous way to, you know, have a child be born without, you know, all of the, you know, sacrifices that, you know, women make to carry pregnancy. So I think those would be like the two really big ones. And I think, you know, we're going to see like a bunch of milestones, like every couple of years along the way toward those two kind of holy grails. But I don't think that there's going to be anything insane. Maybe there is, but I don't think there's going to be anything like super insane over the next couple of years. I would say over the next couple of years, hopefully what we'll see is that all this technology just becomes much more reliable, automated, less expensive, right? So we know how to make IVF more reliable, automated, less expensive. It's just a matter of like kind of throwing the like operational hammer and like engineering mindset of like, let's actually go and make that happen. And I think that's going to be driven by demand, right? Because I think that IVF used to be kind of this like niche field for people who are doing it just for infertility. And there's a lot more people who are infertile, because infertility is like a natural thing that affects everyone with age. So many more people are in that category because society as a whole is choosing to have children later. So that's putting more pressure on it. And then the second thing that's putting more pressure on it is ORCID, right? So it's not just that IVF is for people who are infertile. It could be IVF is for all these people who want to just mitigate the maximum amount of risk for the most important decision in their life, right? So it's sort of like, you know, sex is for fun and like ORCID or IVF is for babies, right? It's that when you're making this really important decision, you don't want to just get a random outcome. You want to have the most information and make sure that you've done everything possible to make sure that your baby and your child isn't affected by something that we already know is harmful. So I think that's also going to put a ton of pressure on IVF to basically ramp up and to kind of, you know, service that like increasing demand from like a much broader set of folks rather than kind of the more narrow set that's been using it, you know, historically for the last 40 years.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot on the horizon. Some of it might be further out, but hopefully some milestones along the way. And to your point, at least some hopefully some driving down of costs and just making this more accessible for people who do want to prioritize it for all the sensible reasons we've talked about. I know we're coming up on time, so one more question for you, a little bit removed from sort of the reproductive health and babies and whatnot, and actually focusing on sort of like the other side of the spectrum of kind of complete lifespan and health span. I thought it was interesting. I don't know like how intentional this was or whatever, but at least somewhere I read like Orchid's mission was actually to extend the health span of the next generation. And it's like, that's not like super obvious that that would be the mission given like what you guys are doing today. But I'm curious to hear, like, you know, I've had a bunch of people on the podcast. Like my first guest was like very much in the, you know, sort of one of the pioneers of like slowing and reversing aging and just taking more of like an engineering approach to aging directly, as opposed to trying to, you know, go and cure all these different cancers and all these different diseases that people die from, and just being like, well, what if we could slow or reverse aging itself and focus on aging itself? So I'm curious if you have any sort of thoughts on that field. And I don't know if Orchid's going to like play in that field at all, but basically your thoughts on the possibility that we could kind of radically extend human health span through attacking aging directly.
Yeah, I think all of that work is super amazing. So for Orchid's mission, in terms of like, we want to extend the health span of the next generation, it really just means that so many people's quality of life is cut short by these genetic diseases, right? You have 30 million Americans who are living with a rare disease, right? And rare meaning individually rare, but in aggregate common, right? So all of these typos, when you add them up, there's 30 million Americans that are affected by it, right? That's a massive amount of people. And there's this orphan drug problem where, because each disease is individually rare, it doesn't make economic sense for drug companies to focus on a cure, right? Because it's really hard to recruit the clinical trial. You never get the R&D dollars back that you invest in. So basically what it means to like extend the health span in the Orchid context is that basically parents are able to identify risks in embryos before transfer, before they emerge, so that those diseases don't end up hijacking their life, right? So it's actually much, much more humble than trying to solve the longevity problem, because basically once you're already sick, once you're already degrading, once something's already wrong, it's much harder to like fix the car that's already in motion, if that makes sense. But basically, if you just like take a snapshot of a genome, and if you take a snapshot of hundreds of thousands of genomes, now we know, hey, these typos cause these really severe diseases. This genetic signatures of this combination of like millions of genetic factors leads to someone being high risk. We don't understand exactly how or why. We don't have like a drug to be able to solve it, but we just know, like empirically, like, you know, these people get the disease five times as often, like 10 years earlier than other people do. So that's what we mean by extending health span. It's basically just like, let's just be an aggregator of all the best knowledge that we have today. Give that to parents when they're making this decision, so that like everyone has this natural distribution of risk between like them and their partner of like the set of siblings or embryos that they could create. Why don't we make it so that instead of getting unlucky with like a really, you know, tragic outcome, like there's, you know, unfortunate situations where these kids will die in pregnancy or die within the first couple of weeks of life. Let's avoid all these like really awful scenarios and instead make it so that, you know, parents can get a little bit more of the healthier side of the distribution, so that this like super amazing investment that they make ends up getting to have like the most time to go do the things that they really care about.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's actually kind of almost the inverse of like what I was saying, where it's like, you know, rather than go after the big diseases, you go after aging. That's like the big, you know, jackpot winner. But it sounds like what you guys are doing is actually kind of addressing the long tail, which, for, you know, it makes sense that drug companies aren't producing drugs for them and things like that. And this long tail, even though each individual, you know, bar on the chart is like quite short, the aggregate is like 30 million Americans, I think you said. So it's like, makes a material difference on obviously the health span for these individuals, but also
the quality of life, right? It's just like it sucks to basically go on this diagnostic odyssey where like for years or sometimes decades people have no idea why they're sick or what's causing them. They take all these different drugs that sometimes make their symptoms worse. I mean, it's really cool. There's already like newborn screening stuff happening where like once a baby's born, they get screened for like a subset of things. They usually get screened for the subset of things that are actionable. So something that you can do to kind of like mitigate or like decrease how bad the progression of the disease is. So I think all that stuff is cool. It's just that it's always a fraction of the total things that you could know, right? Because once the baby's already born, it could be like an info hazard to know about something that might not affect them, or that there's nothing that they can do about, versus at the embryo stage, it's crazy, right? At the embryo stage, you can actually know more than you can know during the pregnancy, because when you're pregnant, you know, it's a lot harder to access that fetal DNA. So basically you have this, like, I don't know, it's like kind of crazy. You have like this magical window that I think no one really thought we would ever have, because no one thought that like IVF would ever work, that like culturing embryos outside of the body would ever work. And then, yeah, basically, yeah, it's crazy. Just like the quality of sequencing that you can get from an embryo is actually better than the quality that you can get from basically a pregnancy that's already in progress today, just because you have the mother's blood and the circulating fetal blood. So it's a harder, it's hilariously a harder problem to do it from the mother's blood than from a few cells from an embryo.
Yeah, well, it's super cool. And again, congratulations on the recent announcement and you know, years of hard work finally coming to fruition. It's great to be able to talk with you about it at this time, especially. So I appreciate you taking the time. Where can people go who want to, you know, prospective parents who want to take maybe the first action or the first step? Where would you guide people? And then secondarily, where can they continue to follow along with you and with the Orchid's journey?
Yeah, you can check out orchidhealth.com to get access to either a embryo report or a saliva report. And then you can follow the company on Twitter at, I think the handle is at Orchid. Maybe you can help me out with that. I think it's at Orchid or Orchid Health. And then I'm at Noor Siddiqui, Noor_Siddiqui.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Noor. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Have a good one. Thanks so much.